There is more to me, Queen Eliara of Elfgard, than my elven magic. Just as there's more to Geico than saving you money, Geico also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the Geico app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite!
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
This is the No Long Twos podcast. I'm your host, Mike Savagno. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at No Long Twos and get all the latest content at nolongtwos.wordpress.com. Great news, we're now on iTunes. Follow us at No Long Twos, subscribe to the podcast, and leave us a 5-star review. It really helps. All aboard! And welcome to this week's three-man weave edition of the No Long Twos podcast. I'm Mike Savagno. I'm joined here in Philadelphia by Jake Hurley.
Happy to be here, Mike. And Mike.
And over Skype, we got Mike Podolsky.
What's going on, guys? Just taking a little break from final studying here. Talk a little NBA hoops.
Yeah, final studying has me down as well. So I've been looking forward to this podcast all week. Basically, what we're going to do today is we're about a quarter of the way through the NBA season. We had Klay Thompson dropping 60 last night. What we want to do is check in on all the NBA awards. We're going to start out with MVP.
So I think it's pretty much a no-brainer for me as far as my MVP pick. I went with Russell Westbrook. I mean, the guy's averaging 32-11-11 at this point. His usage rating is through the roof. It's over 41 at this point. But he just threw up his sixth straight triple-double in his 11th in 22 games this year. And really, it's just been pretty astounding to watch Russ basically carry this Thunder team to 14 wins so far and really have them in pretty good position to make the playoffs.
I have to totally agree on this one with Russell Westbrook. Averaging a triple-double, I don't know if he's going to get it done through the entire season, but the numbers that he's starting off with are unbelievable. I talked about this with a buddy, and he was saying that if Russ's team was losing and he was putting up these numbers, he probably wouldn't be in the conversation for MVP, but I rebutted that with, I don't think he could lose putting up these numbers. I mean, with 31 points and then 11 assists, you got guys scoring the ball. Unless this team takes a huge dive later on in the season, I can't see him losing the MVP award.
I went with Russell Westbrook as well, against my better judgment. I'm not the biggest fan of his game. It's been noted on here, but I don't think you can really pick anyone else at this point. He's leading the league in box plus minus and value over replacement. He's third in PER, sixth in RPM. Like you said, he has the highest usage rating in the league, and the Thunder are 20 points better when he's on the floor versus when he's off. The Thunder are the 13th best team in net rating, so they're kind of right around the middle there, but they've gotten a lot of wins, so they might be outplaying their net rating a little bit. And if they're going to stay in that maybe 4th, 5th, 6th range, I think that, like you said, Mike, Russ is the MVP this season. And that's a difference from what we've seen in the past. And, you know, nobody's won the MVP award in the NBA being a 3 seed or less. So it would definitely be a change, but I don't really think how you can pick anyone other than Russell Westbrook at this point. For me, the second guy on the list, if I was going to pick a second guy, would be James Harden. He's averaging 29, 7, and 11. He's shooting 84% from the line. He's also averaging over 5 turnovers a game, but the Rockets are 14 and 7. That's good for 4th in the West, and he's been the leader of this team, much like Westbrook's been the leader of his.
Yeah, Beard's been pretty incredible so far this year for the Rockets. I mean, I know that I love him and his fit in their offense, really, and that Mike D'Antoni spread offense where he can just really drive and kick and create his own shot really at will. But the guy that I actually went with for my second MVP pick, and really I almost talked myself into picking him as my MVP, but really couldn't do it with Russ, is Russ's former teammate Kevin Durant. He's thrown up 27 points a game this year, 8 rebounds, 5 assists. He's shooting 56% from the field, and he's also leading the league in win shares for that Golden State team, who's 18-3 right now. KD's basically doing the exact opposite of what Russell Westbrook's doing, and that's just being extremely efficient shooting the ball. He's still scoring it at a pretty high rate, leading the Warriors in scoring. What he's doing this year is probably no surprise to anyone with the group that he's surrounded with and the talent that's around him, but I really don't think that you could pick against anyone but Russ as far as the MVP race goes so far.
Yeah, I think my second pick, it's tough because of how many guys are going to share votes with teammates. I mean, you got LeBron and Kyrie in Cleveland. You got the three-headed monster in Golden State. The only real way I could see Russ losing it is if someone has a tremendous second half of the year, maybe Kawhi or Blake Griffin or somebody that's always been in the conversation these past couple of years that just somehow sparks a good run for their team and they finish above where they were projected to, and they're the main reason why they do it. But like you guys said, there's no way that Russ loses it unless they severely fall off.
Yeah, previously we had talked about Chris Paul potentially being in this conversation. I think that he's fallen off a little bit. Not necessarily the fault of the Clippers. They're still 16-6, but he's turning the ball over a little bit more. He's down in points and assists. I think that he's still worthy of mentioning, as well as LeBron James. Obviously, Cavs, 3-game losing streak. They got back on the winning track against Toronto. With the Cavs, as we've discussed many times, it's a lot about effort more than anything. LeBron seemed to take a couple games off, especially when they went to Milwaukee and played against Giannis. But he's still at 24-7-9. He's shooting 50% from the field. Cavs are going to be first in the East. They already swept the season series with the Raptors, so the Raptors will not pass them in a case of a tiebreak. That's definitely something that the Cavs had on their radar. Like you talked about, Mike, I think Kawhi's got to be on this list. The Spurs are quietly 17-4. They've been unbelievable on the road and actually terrible at home, which is not something that you usually see. But Kawhi's definitely someone who's carrying that team more than he has in past years. Anthony Davis, a guy who's obviously been joined by Drew Holiday. The Pelicans have gotten a little better. They're now 7-15. He's throwing up 31.6 a night, which leads the league. He's also first in PER, which is something that we'd like to use. And finally, Marlins woman, Jimmy Butler. I think he's worthy of the conversation as well. He's putting up 26-6-4. He's third in win shares. He's getting to the line 10 times a game. But the Bulls have gone into a dive recently. They're now 11-10. And so I think that keeps Jimmy Butler probably outside of the top five. But it's important to recognize what he's done on the court as well.
So the next award that we're going to look at through the quarterway of the season is going to be Coach of the Year. So Mike, who you got? Either one.
Kind of alluded to mine with your secondary pick of MVP, and that's Mike D'Antoni. I think the way he has his Rockets team playing is way above what people thought. Their defensive efficiency rating isn't where he probably wants it to be, but I don't think anybody expected it to be very low. He just has James Harden playing in a role that he's supposed to play in, and he's figuring out a way to win with guys that people probably didn't see him winning with. I have another pick later on, also from the Houston Rockets, a little spoiler alert. But I just think D'Antoni is overachieving at the beginning of the year here. He beat the Warriors in Golden State, and then on the second night of a back-to-back, had his team playing tremendous in Denver. That was one of the best second nights of back-to-backs going into Denver, which is one of the hardest places to play at altitude in the second game of a back-to-back. And he had his team from the start playing hard. So I think that this guy is really tuned in with his team, and he's got him ready to go. It'd be interesting to see, because of how good the West is at the top half, what they're able to do going on throughout the season and then essentially into the playoffs. But I think the way he has his team playing right now, he's definitely got to be the front runner for Coach of the Year.
I also went with Mike D'Antoni. The Rockets were 9-11 through 20 games last year, but more importantly in my mind, they were playing uninspired basketball and were very hard to watch. Dwight Howard was moping. This year, Mike D'Antoni's in there. He's spreading it out. He's got James Harden leading the charge. They're 14-7. They're 7th best in net rating. In addition to that win in Golden State, they've also won in San Antonio. And I think the thing for me is that the Rockets are, first, incredibly watchable, which is a change from last year. I still dislike that D'Antoni hasn't grown out the mustache. Apparently, he claims that it makes him look younger to not have it. I disagree, but apparently you're not going to convince the man this year. But the Rockets really are playing well. That back-to-back in Denver was extremely impressive because they got to their hotel at almost 5 in the morning and still got the win later that night. And so I was upset when Steve Kerr actually won Coach of the Month for the month of November. I don't really think that Steve Kerr has any way to win this award this year unless they want 82-0, because you expect them to win, you know, 67, 70, 72 games. So I think that Mike D'Antoni should have won Coach of the Month in November, and he's also my pick for Coach of the Year so far.
So as far as my Coach of the Year pick, I did consider Coach D'Antoni of the Rockets. I think that the Rockets probably had a bit lower expectations than the coach that I went with, and that's Coach Fizz down in Memphis. He's got the Grizzlies at 14-8 right now, so a half game behind the Rockets. They're locked in a close one right now with the Sixers, hoping to move to 15-8. But really what I think Coach Fizz has been able to do in Memphis to get really the most out of that team and really kind of embrace the grit and grind that Coach Dave Yeager had before that, and then kind of incorporate his own scheme from Miami and just what he's experienced in his time in the NBA. I think he's really gotten the most out of the guys down there. He's been plagued by injuries. Zebo's missed a couple of games due to the death of his mother. Chandler Parsons, obviously, well chronicled all of his injuries. Mike Conley just going out last week, really having no one at point guard. Last night, Troy Daniels put up 28. The dude only had two other counting stats. It was a pretty incredible line to look at. But really, I'm just really impressed by what Coach Fizz has been able to do. Granted, Memphis is never really going to be a watchable team. they never play really an attractive brand of basketball, but he's winning games right now, and that's really all you can ask out of your first-year coach.
Yeah, I think the thing that's going to hurt Fizz, like you said, is the injuries. I don't know how far he's going to be able to take this team once they get into the grinding part of the season, the halfway to three-quarter way part of the year, if they're going to still be in the playoff contention or if they're going to be playing meaningful basketball late in the season. Another guy that I considered was Clifford out in Charlotte. He had a great year last year, obviously, and coming out this year, starting off 12-9, third in the East, they haven't been playing the best basketball, but I think the good start early on, once they do start clicking and they go on a couple longer win streaks, people are going to start realizing what he has out in Charlotte. And even into the playoffs, the bottom half of the East is so jumbled up that they're probably going to get in as a 3 or 4 seed and not have to see the Cavs until the later part of the playoffs. So he's going to have a good run with his team, and he could be a contender.
I think that overall this year, there's just a lot of better coaches in the league than last year, and I think that that's something positive for the league. We have Coach Fizz, like you talked about, Jake, as well as Kenny Atkinson up in Brooklyn. Those are two guys who are embracing kind of the three-point mentality. They are allowing their centers to shoot three. Marc Gasol made a step-back three to send the game to overtime last night, which was like living in a different planet. Then Brook Lopez is shooting nearly 3.5 threes a game. Coach Luke out in L.A., they started off hot. They've been a little worse lately, but I think he's been revealed as Steve Kerr's marijuana dealer. so we can definitely see why those guys had a nice little bond after Kerr's comments on marijuana. But really, between the influx of great coaches this year and the ability of these coaches to speak their minds, you've seen Pop, Steve Kerr, Stan Van Gundy as three examples of guys who have spoken up about the election as well as other things that have been going on. And so I think it's been a real renaissance for NBA coaches, and we're in a pretty solid era for that. So even though these guys are our picks to win Coach of the Year so far, I think that some of the other coaches definitely deserve recognition for kind of bringing the game even further into this era.
All right, the next award we're going to look at is the Most Improved Player. Mike, go ahead, start us out. Who you got?
I'm going with Giannis. Giannis has been pretty remarkable this entire season. He's averaging 22-8-6 on 53% shooting from the field, which would be the best of his career. NBA Math is a new website, and they do a total points added metric, which is essentially your box plus minus on offense and defense multiplied by your time on the court. So last year, Giannis had a 138.5 total points added, and this year he's projected for 444, which that would, first of all, be fifth in the NBA, but secondly, that 306-point jump would be the largest in the league. He's eighth in PER, fourth in win shares per 48, third in box plus minus, and fifth in VORP. And he's seeing a career high in rebound percentage, assist percentage, free throw rate, steal percentage, and block percentage. So this is a guy who I think has improved in all facets of the game. And when you watch him play, it's pretty remarkable how well he gets out in transition. He's almost, I think he is 7 feet tall. Kevin Garnett was actually at their practice today, and he's taller than him. And I'm pretty sure Garnett stands at 7 feet tall. So this guy's barreling downhill at nearly 7 feet tall, and he's doing, some would say, a Euro step. I would even call it something even more than that because of how long his steps are. So unless you're fouling him, if you're not ahead of him in the break, I don't really see how you stop this guy in transition. He's leading the league in restricted area attempts, and he's essentially vaulted the Bucks team into the playoff conversation when, after they lost Chris Middleton, I don't think really anyone expected them to be there.
Yeah, there was a solid insider article this week that actually talked a lot about him, and just as far as his development and what he's kind of morphing into under Jason Kidd's tutelage. And Kidd had mentioned earlier this week that he thinks that Giannis could kind of be a combination of Dirk and LeBron. Now, that's not something that I necessarily see, but to an extent, I guess you can sort of see where he's coming from, just because Dirk's a 7-footer. He has good touch. He's very difficult to guard from all spots on the floor. And then he has the passing ability of LeBron. He might have the strength of LeBron going forward. And he's just great at barreling downhill, like you mentioned, and getting into the paint, creating his own shot, and then also creating shots for others. But the guy that I went with for most improved, and he's a guy that we talked a bit about on earlier versions of the podcast, is Zach LaVine out in Minnesota. He's averaging 20 points a game this year, only 3 rebounds, 3 assists, and like we had mentioned on those previous episodes, he's probably a bit overshadowed by what Towns and Wiggins are doing this year in Minnesota, but I really think that Zach LaVine has taken that next step forward. A lot of people questioned what his position was going to be in the NBA. They weren't sure if he was going to be able to stick because he really couldn't shoot. Last year, he didn't really play great on the ball. They weren't sure how he's going to play off the ball once Rubio was healthy. But this year, he's really taken a step forward, and really, he's almost one of their go-to guys on offense. And in crunch time, he's shooting 46% from the field, 37% from three, which again is a lot higher than what most people expected, and then 90% from the line. So he's getting the line at a decent clip, not as high as his teammate Wiggins or Towns, but he's shooting it extremely well, and I really think that he's taken really the leap this year.
I agree. Both the guys brought up have great years. The most improved player award in the NBA, I think, is one of the weirdest awards. People always have this weird expectation of who should win it. I mean, when you have Steph Curry in the talks for winning most improved player, it's just hard to take it serious because it's a guy who year in and year out is putting up these huge numbers. And guys like that, I don't think were made for the most improved player. I think that with last year, with CJ winning it, they're starting to understand what it actually means to be an improved player. It's someone who didn't really affect their team, and didn't really have a big role, and then the next year, that step. And my guy is a little under the radar. I don't think many people are talking about it. I alluded to earlier. Mine's Clint Capella.
Ooh. Okay.
The guy is filling a huge hole in the Rockets team, no matter how you feel about Dwight Howard. But the guy is shooting 64% from the field. He's averaging 12 points a game, 8.5 rebounds. He's really helping Harden in Harden being who Mike D'Antoni wants him to be. He's getting 14.7% of Harden's passes, which is fourth on the team, but he's converting 3 of Harden's assists a game. And a lot of what Harden's doing is driving to the bucket and finding guys underneath, and Clint Capella is the beneficiary of most of those passes. Like I said, he's highly overshadowed with how well Harden's playing this year, but he is a huge piece of that team. And I think depending on how far they go and how good they play this year, people are going to start realizing what Clint Capela means to that team. Outside of their three-point shooters, which they have some tremendous three-point shooters, he's really the only threat inside. And he's not really shooting well from the free throw line, so he's kind of just replacing Dwight Howard. But he's having a great year so far, and if he can continue it at this pace, I think he should be at least considered for most improved player.
I like the idea of Clint Capela because he's essentially playing that Dwight Howard role, but with more energy, and he's really bought into that rolling mentality that you talked about, whereas Dwight Howard always wants the ball in the post. Capela says, no post-ups, I'm going to roll, I'm going to catch lobs, and I'm going to make an impact on the game. Another guy that I wanted to highlight is Julius Randle. He's averaging only 12.6, 8.7, and 3.5, but that's the best points and assists of his career. He's shooting 51% from the field. Going back to that total points added metric, he was actually negative 168 points last year, and he's projected for 51 points this year, so that's an added value of 219 points, which is third best in the NBA. He's been a better fit on this new type of Lakers team under Coach Luke. He's not a guy who's going to shoot threes, but he's been able to make an impact driving. He's very left-hand dominant. He likes the ball on that side of the floor. I think he's improved defensively a little bit this year, which is something that you would like to see from a guy with his body type. And so I wanted to highlight him as well as Otto Porter, who I actually picked before last season to win Most Improved Player. He didn't take the step last year that I thought he might have, but he's actually been very good this year. He's averaging 15-8, 53% from the field, 61% true shooting, which is the best of his career. His PER is nearly 20 now. I think Otto Porter is another guy who's improving, but it's not really making an impact in Washington, and that's why I wouldn't have him necessarily around the top two.
So I really like the idea of Capela, too, as the most improved player. I think that, like you guys both said, he's really the perfect complement to James Harden. I kind of liken him to a Tristan Thompson in Cleveland. He knows exactly what his role is. He's a lob catcher. He's a rebounder. He's a finisher. He's not going to ask for the ball in the post like Dwight does. So I really do think that he's a great fit for that Houston team. He plays his role perfectly. He's a springier version of Howard, and I really do like the progress that he's made. Another guy that I kind of looked at just a bit, just because I really think that he's kind of taken another step forward, maybe not the biggest step, but that's KCP in Detroit. I think he's shouldering a bit more of the load offensively. He's always going to take the best either guard or wing offensive player assignment that night. He's not going to lead the team in scoring. He has improved his shooting quite a bit. He's averaging a career high in points this year. He's averaging a little over 16 a game, which I really think has helped Detroit, and they've been a surprise team, which we might touch on in a little bit. But yeah, really like where KCP's gone this year, and I really think that we all had three pretty solid choices as far as most improved goes this year.
If KCP were listening to that, he'd send it to his agent and tell him that he needs to get paid this offseason.
Okay, can I bring up a little KCP fun fact? The Youngstown State University Penguins beat the Georgia Bulldogs in Georgia when KCP was there. Can't remember the exact final score.
How many minutes did you play?
Actually played a few minutes that game.
Oh, wow.
Wet the beak a little.
4 minutes. We had a little foul trouble early. I played first half minutes, which is better.
Uh-oh. Were they sure that you were out there? Did the coach get confused?
Oh, yeah. KCP went nuts, but we ended up with the victory.
Wet the beak a little.
We'll cut that part.
Quarter season award that we're going to take a look at is Sixth Man of the Year. As far as this award goes, and I know that Podolsky agrees with both Drake and I, and our sixth man is Lou Will out in LA.
Yeah, going into maybe 2 weeks ago, I definitely thought someone from the Warriors was going to win Sixth Man of the Year. Most likely Andre Iguodala. Because of his use in the death lineup.
JaVale McGee?
Is double rat tail.
However, the fact that Coach Luke has decided to start Brandon Ingram and Meta World Peace and still bring Lou Will off the bench to continue his role as the sixth man has me convinced that he should be the Sixth Man of the Year. Two games with injuries, with Nick Young, D'Angelo Russell, Larry Nance, all these guys being hurt. He's still coming off the bench and dropping big numbers. His last two games, he's dropped 40-plus and 38. The guy just gets buckets. And in the NBA, I said this before when I was with Mike earlier in the podcast, the second group is what wins games. Watching that Utah game last night, Utah started the third quarter 12-0, and then Coach Luke brought in Lou Will, and he went on a 6-0 run by himself. The guy can just completely turn games. He's still passing the ball, too. He's not just chucking up shots, and I think he had 6 or 7 assists last night with his 38 points, but he's just doing what he did back in Toronto, and it's finally translating over to the Lakers. And as long as the Lakers stay somewhat in the playoff hunt, I think it's Lou Will's to lose.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that sentiment. Lou Will, he's one of those guys where he's never really seemed to fit into a starting role. He really hasn't been successful, and then every time he comes off the bench, he's just kind of instant offense. That's, I think, probably where he's most comfortable. He leads the Lakers in scoring. He also leads the Lakers in assists, which I thought was kind of interesting. He's only averaging 3.5 assists a game, which is probably a little bit bigger issue as far as their team goes, where they don't have very many assists. If Lou Will's leading you in assists, I just don't think that you could really pick anyone else. I think that Sixth Man of the Year kind of has a tendency to be like Rookie of the Year, where it's a little bit more counting stats, and Lou Will's averaging almost 20 a game this year, so he's certainly my pick.
A little nugget on that game last night between the Lakers and the Jazz. The artist formerly known as Ron Artest was a minus 26 in the game that the Lakers lost by 6 points. So maybe don't play that guy. I also went with Lou Will. I think I agree with everything that you guys said. Per 36 minutes, he's scoring 26 a night. He's at a career high in PER, true shooting, steal percentage, and box plus minus. The biggest thing for me is that the Lakers are 20 points better per 100 possessions with him on the floor. I think both of you guys kind of touched on his impact. I wanted to put a number to that. One guy that I did want to talk about who I think should finish second at this point is Wilson Chandler. I was very happy for him to return. One of the things is that he's essentially playing starter minutes. He's getting 31 a night, but he is averaging a career high 18.6 points, career high 7.3 rebounds. He's shooting 48% from the field, and he also has a career high in PER, true shooting, usage percentage, and box plus minus. And the Nuggets, although they've struggled, they're much better with him on the floor, 7 points per 100 possessions. So I think that despite some of the rotation issues that they have in Denver with their bigs and Kenneth Fareed, a guy who I think should be traded, Wilson Chandler has kind of locked down that four position in many of their small ball lineups, and he's at least a stabilizing force for a Nuggets team that's still young and still struggling.
Yeah, Wilson Chandler has actually been one of my favorite NBA kind of under the radar guys to watch. He's with as you touched on, a severely young team out in Denver, and I think his experience really helps that squad. I just want to see him stay healthy throughout the year. I know there was talks last year when the Cavs went down 3-1 in the finals. Me and Mike were talking about who the Cavs needed to take that next step before they went on that comeback.
It was a sad walk.
And Wilson Chandler was one of the names that was brought up, and I'd love to see him in Cleveland. But the guy, kind of along the lines of Lou Will, he just understands his role. And to be a sixth man, it's not just something you can do. Like, you can't take a starter, put him on the bench, and say, hey, you're coming off the bench, you're going to be our sixth man. That's not something that just happens. The guy understands his role. He knows what he's supposed to do with that second group when he comes off the bench.
Yeah, and he's a guy who he missed all of last year with that hip surgery. I know Mike and I were watching that Rockets and Nuggets game, and I know that you alluded to it earlier, but he just looked like he had that bounce back from before the surgery, and he just looks really healthy at this point. Hopefully he stays healthy, because obviously he's having a great year, putting up career numbers. The guy can defend a couple positions on the wing. He can defend a little bit bigger-bodied guys down in the post because he's a little bit stronger, but really a great story for Wilson Chandler this year, and certainly would be in contention for Sixth Man of the Year.
Next award we want to talk about is Defensive Player of the Year. Kawhi Leonard has won this award 2 years in a row. He's a guy that we talked about in our preseason picks as potentially being a three-time winner. But right now, I'm not going Kawhi Leonard. I'm actually going Draymond Green, the nut puncher himself. Draymond is leading the NBA in defensive RPM. He's third in defensive box plus minus. And I think that one of the things that's distinguished him so far for me from Kawhi Leonard is his ability to make an impact on the game almost at all times. I was watching the end of both the Hawks game and the Warriors-Rockets thriller this past week. And in the Hawks game, he got switched on to Dennis Schroeder late in the game. Schroeder went to the left, tried to make a move. Draymond stayed with him, swatted him out of bounds. He made some big plays at the end of that Rockets game before the kicking James Harden incident. I didn't think it was as intentional as the Adams or even the Marquise Chris that we saw later in the weekend. But Draymond Green is able to make an impact when he's on the floor at all times. And one of the things I've seen from the Spurs actually this year, I was watching the Spurs Magic game to try to see why the Spurs weren't playing very well. And what the Magic were essentially doing was taking the guy that Kawhi Leonard was guarding and just putting him in the opposite corner and running everything from the other side of the floor, whether it was a pick and roll, dribble handoff, something like that. And Kawhi Leonard wasn't able to really have that impact. He's not technically a free safety. He's much more of an on-ball disruptor, getting the passing lanes type guy. And so I think that teams have recognized that and have been playing a little bit of 4-on-4, and that's why I have Draymond Green over Kawhi Leonard so far.
Yeah, at this point, I agree with the Draymond Green pick. Really, Klay has kind of decreased his load of being that defensive stopper in Golden State. They score so many points that they're not going to sit down in a half-court defensive set and get stops every time down. They're going to make plays, and Draymond Green is that playmaker on the backside of their defense. The one guy that I do think is going to give him a little run for his money might be Hassan Whiteside. Miami actually plays defense, so to be the best defender on a team that actually prides themselves on defense is a big thing for me. The guy is essentially a rim protector. It's tough to get buckets at the rim with him in the game, and I just think that Miami might not be good enough for him to win it, but I think that the award should go to the best defensive player on a defensive team, and Hassan Whiteside is that guy.
Yeah, so like you guys both picked, I'm also going with Draymond Green. I have no idea how you can play such great defense only breathing from your mouth, also while being a donkey. But, I mean, like you guys both said, he really affects all aspects of the game. He can guard 1 through 5 no problem. I mean, the guy's 6'6", but he has a barrel chest. He can go up against really anyone
former
in the league.
Former fat guy.
Yeah, I definitely miss fat Draymond Green when he wasn't good. When he played football and got lit up for Michigan State. But I mean,
he used to get stuffed in trash cans at the YMCA.
Breathes like that, freezes on camera. But I mean, you can't take away from the guy's skill and talents and everything he does for that Warriors team. We talked earlier in the year, we thought that maybe he was going to be the guy that maybe imploded a little bit, that was unhappy with his role, but he's really taken on that stopper role. And I hate Steve Kerr campaigning 15 games into the year for Draymond Green as Defensive Player of the Year, but I guess that's just a Steve Kerr thing to do. The guy's obviously outspoken, as we saw with his comments earlier this week. He's not afraid to talk about anything.
He could have been high.
Yeah, unconfirmed. But another guy that I considered and I was really close to going with was Rudy Gobert in Utah. I think Utah is one of probably the top five defensive teams in the league by all metrics. When he has Derek Favors playing alongside with him, they really just absolutely dominate teams inside. People shoot right around 50% at the rim when Gobert's testing their shots, which is just a staggering number. The guy's 7'3", has a 7'9 wingspan. He can really jump extremely well. Just affects basically every single shot at the rim, anything really within almost 10 feet. And just does a great job of anchoring one of the best defensive teams and one of the most exciting teams really in the league when healthy in the Utah Jazz.
One thing Rudy Gobert has going for him is if Dwight Howard taught us anything about winning Defensive Player of the Year, it's shooting horribly from the free throw line. he's shooting a record, 67%? It's a blistering percentage from the free throw line. So I like the Rudy Gobert pick. I mean, guys that need to be on the floor, even barring their horrible free throw shooting percentage, such as DeAndre Jordan, shows you their defensive prowess.
For the final award that we want to hit before we touch on some surprises and disappointments, we're going to talk about the Embiid of the year, the process of the year, the rookie of the year, Joel Embiid. He has a 24.7 PER. He's averaging nearly 19-8 on 48% from the field, 51% from three, 77% from the line. And one of the things that is important here for me, granted, the rest of the rookie class has really struggled, is that the Sixers are 13 points per 100 possessions better with Joel Embiid on the floor. Their defense would be one of the best defenses in the league when he's actually playing. When he sits, their defense is really terrible, one of the worst defenses in the league. And so I think that him making an impact on that end is a huge factor in this award, despite the fact that this isn't really a competition.
Yeah, I think the time off really helped Joel translate his game into the NBA. Being a Kansas fan, I watched him play in his 1 year as a Jayhawk, and he had huge hype around him, but people didn't really know what he was going to do in the NBA. I think having the time off really allowed him to develop his game and work to become a premier NBA player, and it's working. I mean, the guy is by far the best player on his team. Obviously, the team's not very good, but he's leading them to a decent season, and it's going to be interesting to see once the Sixers get everybody back what that team can actually be. But like you said, this isn't even a contest here. If Joel Embiid does not win Rookie of the Year, there's something severely wrong with the NBA voting.
Or him, which is a problem.
Right. I mean, I can't even think of another guy who is even close to giving him competition for this award.
Yeah, I think what Embiid's done this year is really pretty incredible, and he's really lived up to the hype and maybe surpassed the hype that that surrounded him when he was originally drafted. Now that he's finally healthy, we're getting a chance to see what he's able to do. The guy's basically 7'2", 7'3", the best shooter on the Sixers team. Like you said, he's shooting 51% from three-point range. Granted, that's basically 51% from the top of the key, the only place where he really shoots threes, but that's okay. Obviously, we went to the Cavs game when they played the Sixers. He affected a lot of shots at the rim. He's so incredibly athletic and long for how big he is. One thing that we noticed was that he's strong, but he doesn't have really a ton of like in-game strength when he's trying to move guys off the block, either on offense or defense. So that's one thing that'll certainly come with time. I think really the last 2 years off and being able to watch a lot of YouTube videos of white kids shooting has really helped his development and made him a better player than going against five trainers or chairs.
Shout out Yee.
Yeah, shout out Chairman Yee. But no, Joel Embiid, this is really a victory lap for him so far. He's going to win the award, barring any, God forbid, any injury. But really, Joel Embiid has taught us one thing, and that's really trust the process.
Trust the process.
I mean, the one thing that kind of scares me about Joel is if you actually watch his game, he's kind of clueless on the defensive end. He plays very well at the rim, but when he gets put in situations with screens, pick and rolls, weak side help, he's kind of lost. He overcommits, and I think that will come with time. It's hard to say that should keep him from winning the Rookie of the Year, I mean, with the numbers he's putting up, but if he wants to take that next step beyond, it's hard to even call it his rookie year because it's just like his first year, but he's been in the league for how long now, but if he wants to take that next step beyond this year, he really needs to develop a feel for the game beyond his individual success and be able to help this team in the team sense of the game more than just his individual play.
I think part of why he looks so good on defense is that he replaces Jahlil Okafor, who is one of the worst defensive players I've ever seen in my entire life. And like you said, getting Nerlens Noel back potentially and Ben Simmons back will be huge for this team. Maybe Okafor and Noel are gone by the start of next season when they really start to try to turn things up. But I would assume that Okafor will be gone. I don't know who wants him. I think that guy is absolutely terrible, but I'm sure someone will take him. And just a reminder that tonight is actually Giannis' birthday. Giannis turned 22 today, which means he is younger than Joel Embiid, younger than Buddy Hield, who's been absolutely awful. And so the fact that Giannis is 22 is just mind-blowing at this point. The guy's going to be an absolute stud. But Joel Embiid, Rookie of the Year, I think that as long as he doesn't get injured, knock on wood, that this isn't even a conversation.
And I think we can all raise a Shirley Temple glass to Joel Embiid tonight, his drink of choice.
And Sam Hinkie.
Trust the process. Welcome back. So now we're going to move on from our individual player and coach awards to some surprising players and teams, and also disappointing players and teams so far this year. So first we're going to start off with the most surprising players that we've seen so far this year. So my original pick was going to be Isaiah Thomas of the Boston Celtics, but after I thought about it a little bit more, I don't think that I was really that surprised by it. I'm a big IT guy. I don't love his game, but I kind of like it. It fits in Boston. He's a great player. My most surprising player this year, super under the radar guy, a guy that most people probably know from his college days, and that's Sean Kilpatrick for the Brooklyn Nets. He's averaging over 16 points a game this year. The guy's low-key kind of getting buckets for that Nets team, especially in Jeremy Lin's absence. He has a great story. His first ever NBA game, he played a D-League game earlier in the day. He hopped on a bus or a train to New York City, and then he played like 45 minutes that night. He's played less than 60 games total in his NBA career, but really happy to kind of see Sean Kilpatrick's early season success this year for the Brooklyn Nets.
I tried to zag as well. I had Isaiah Thomas down because he is averaging a career best in points and assists. He's getting to the line more than he ever has. He's 13th in PER, and I thought that it was pretty impressive that he was able to kind of carry that Celtics team when Al Horford was out and Jay Crowder was sidelined with an injury as well. But for my most surprising player, I'm actually going with Trevor Booker from the Nets as well. He's averaging a career high in points, rebounds, and assists. He has a career high 58 true shooting percentage. And one of the things that I thought with Trevor Booker going to the Nets is that he might not even start. I didn't think that he would really make an impact. I thought he was okay last year in Utah, but not great. But he actually has a career high in PER at nearly 19, a career high in assist percentage at 14, which I think has been important in the Jeremy Lin absence. And he's kind of solidified that power forward spot for the Nets when they might have been starting Luis Scola at one point, which would have been just awful. So I've been impressed with what Trevor Booker has done. And like I said, I tried to really go off the beaten path here. So Trevor Booker for the Nets for me.
I went a little bit of a different route here. I thought about my expectations at the beginning of the year and really just what surprised me most about how the start has been. And mine's Dwayne Wade. I thought the guy was washed. I thought leaving Miami, he was going to be that guy that came off the bench at a certain point in the season, maybe scored about 8 to 10 points a game, maybe didn't even play half the year due to injury. But the start he has, shooting, especially shooting the ball from three this year, has been very surprising. I still don't think the Bulls have figured it out yet with Rondo, Jimmy Butler. But I think once they get everything under control, maybe halfway through the year, most likely going to be in the playoffs, probably be a 7 or 8 seed. But I think that the way Dwayne Wade's playing this year, I'm not saying he's breaking records and doing stuff like that career-wise, but it's just surprising to me to see him change scenery and have such a big impact on this team right away.
And become a pseudo-Cubs fan who forces LeBron to wear a Cubs uniform to the game.
I'm just glad it was a custom LeBron Cubs jersey instead of actually wearing a Cubs jersey. It like made it that much better.
I guess the I'm Coming Home tribute video to Dwayne Wade didn't convince you that he was going to be a good player.
All right, now moving on from most surprising player, we're going to go with the most surprising team. For me, it's not really based on expectation. It's just looking at this season. It's the Memphis Grizzlies. They have had some of the worst luck that a team could have in the first 23 games of the year, but they've never faltered. As we mentioned earlier, Fizz has this team really bought in and playing well. They have guys that I don't even know if they belong in the D-League, but they're balling for the Memphis Grizzlies. They just picked up another win tonight. Granted, it was over a shorthanded Philadelphia 76ers team, but winning games in the NBA is tough, especially when you don't have your main guys. But it's crazy to see guys like Troy Daniels putting up 29 in an NBA game. I said it earlier, I don't know how long they can sustain this, but this early on in the year is surprising based on the circumstances what this team has been able to do.
Going with the concept of banking wins, which I think is underrated in this league, I'm going with the Detroit Pistons as my surprising team. Right now, they're 11-11, which is 8th in the East, but they're 9th in SRS, they're 12th in net rating, and they've played the 4th hardest schedule so far this year. And why they've been surprising to me is because I really thought that they were going to struggle mightily without Reggie Jackson. Ish Smith is a decent point guard. I don't think he's a good point guard by any means, but they, in the last week and a half, went into Charlotte, beat them by 23, into Boston, beat them by 7, into Atlanta, beat them by 36, 3 games in a row. Those are 3 teams that are potentially playoff teams in the East, and Detroit went in there without their best player and beat all 3 of them pretty handily. 538 has them projected at 46-36 with an 88% chance to make the playoffs. Reggie Jackson is now back. He's played 2 games. He's on a minutes restriction so far. They lost to the Magic. They won tonight. So they're 1-1 since he returned. And guy that you mentioned earlier, they are 10.3 points per 100 possessions better with KCP on the floor than without. So the fact that this team is in the hunt and likely going to be even in that 4-seed conversation still, despite not having Reggie Jackson, is why they're my most surprising team.
So I'm also going with a team in the Eastern Conference, and actually right now they'd be in the playoffs if the season ended today, and that's the Milwaukee Bucks. It's a team that absolutely blitzed the Cavs last week, or this past weekend, I should say. Really just embarrassed the Cavs in Milwaukee. Jason Kidd really has his team playing pretty well right now. Like we've talked about several times before, this is just an extremely long team. They're a little bit like the Bulls in that they don't really have any shooters. All their pieces are kind of funky, but in a way, it works. Jason Kidd really gets the most out of Giannis. We talked about him a lot earlier. He's having an incredible season. Jabari Parker's really starting to make the leap offensively. John Henson's been an extremely productive player. For some reason, Plumlee is still getting a decent amount of minutes for them, despite the fact that Greg Monroe has been really a great piece for them so far this year. I know that we talked a bit about Greg Monroe offline, just as far as the success that he's had when he's on the floor and the success that the Bucks had when he's on the floor.
Yeah, I really like the Bucks also. The thing about the Bucks is they really play up to their competition, but they also play down to their competition. They've had some terrible losses, in my mind. They lost to Dallas in the game, which they put up 75 points. They lost to Miami in a game that they put up 73 points. But, like you said, they're playing really well as of late. Like you said, they blitzed the Cavs. They should have beaten San Antonio the other night. Took a big comeback from the Spurs to beat the Bucks at home, but they're a team that's playing well, and I had high hopes for them from the beginning, so it's not as surprising for me. I think last year they really showed what they could do in those big games. It's just a matter of if Jason Kidd has them fully focused on the season as a whole, and if they can play consistent night in and night out, no matter who's on the other side of the floor.
Sticking in the Eastern Conference and moving on to disappointing teams, my biggest disappointment by far so far this season is the Atlanta Hawks. They're now 10-12, which is 10th in the East, but their Pythagorean win total is actually worse than that at 9-13. In their last 7, they're 0-7. They have the worst offensive rating in the league, 25th defensive rating, and the worst net rating over those 7 games. In total, they have the 27th best offense. They're projected by our friends at 538 at 36-46 with only a 35% chance to make the playoffs. And the playoff picture at this point in the year is nearly set historically, so it's bad for the Hawks to be on the outside looking in. They added Dwight Howard this offseason. He's in the 28th percentile in post-ups. That's something that's been a change for their offense and not a helpful one, because Dwight Howard has never really been a good post player. And then Dennis Schroeder, who took over the reins from Jeff Teague in the offseason, he has been really terrible, and the Hawks are 10 points per 100 possessions worse with him on the floor. And over the last 10, we had talked about Mike Muscala and Thabo Sefolosha in the past and their contributions when the Hawks were actually 9-2. Sefolosha has a negative 23 net rating when he's on the floor, so that bench has really fallen off, and the Hawks are in a difficult position now on the outside looking in.
Yeah, Coach Bud definitely had the Hawks out to a hot start this year. They've really gotten off to a pretty solid start the past couple years under Coach Bud, but like we talked about earlier, that bench unit in Atlanta really almost carried them earlier in the year. Muscala was leading the league in field goal percentage for the first several weeks of the season. Thabo Sefolosha had an incredible plus-minus. He was just absolutely clowning guys coming off the bench. He had an incredible plus-minus. I think he had the best D rating and one of the best O ratings in the entire league for the first couple weeks. But they've really fallen off. Schroeder is my least favorite player in the league. I've never believed in him to be a good player whatsoever. I have no idea why Atlanta gave him a contract extension. I'm fine with it, I guess, because it doesn't affect my team. In reality, it actually helps my team quite a bit because the guy's a sieve on defense, and we have, oh, by the way, one of the best offensive point guards in the NBA, so I'm okay with that. But my most disappointing team is actually a team that I know that you and I both picked to be in the Western Conference playoffs, and that's the Minnesota Timberwolves. They've just really struggled so far this year. We've talked at great length about their third quarter struggles. They got smacked by 18 in the third quarter tonight after taking a 10-point lead and a half against San Antonio in Minnesota. They ended up losing that game pretty badly. Cat struggled quite a bit in that game, but really where Minnesota struggled the most, and that's the thing that we kind of wondered how they would do, and that's really on the defensive end. They're struggling quite a bit. Wiggins, Towns, and LaVine, I mean, they're three great young talents. They're all three guys who can score it, but they really struggle to defend as a team. They struggle to defend individually, and they've really just struggled overall this year. They're 7-14, now 7-15 at this point. Definitely on the outside looking in of the playoff picture. At this point, they're probably going to be a top five, top seven lottery team. We definitely didn't expect to see in Coach Tibbs' first year, so the Timberwolves are definitely my most disappointing team at this point in the season.
The one reason that I disagree with the Atlanta Hawks being a disappointing team is because when they let both Al Horford and Jeff Teague leave, I didn't expect much out of them this year. As you guys pointed out, Dennis Schroeder can't guard anyone. I didn't really have any high hopes for him. If you look at their starting lineup, it's almost comical to think that this team, how good they were in the past, that they thought that they could get back to where they were by adding Dwight Howard and losing the guys they lost. I had two teams. One was the Minnesota Timberwolves. Jake touched on a lot of the points I was going to bring up with the defense. With Tibbs going in there, everybody thought that he was going to really turn the tide and turn the team into a defensive team, and that just hasn't happened. It might take time. We don't know. Maybe it'll take two or three years for Tibbs to turn things around. And I hope they stick with him because I think he's going to really add some value to that team. But the one team that's disappointed me is the Dallas Mavericks. And it's mostly based off of injuries. They just can't get guys on the floor. And they did a lot to get the guys there that they have. I really wanted to see Harrison Barnes. I mean, obviously he's scoring the points because he has to. They don't have anybody else really that can score the ball with Wes Matthews shooting as bad as he is and Dirk not on the floor. But I was really looking forward to see those guys play together, and it just hasn't happened yet this year, and we don't know if it will. So that's why they've been the most disappointing. It really hasn't been their play on the court, but it's just the fact that they can't get their guys on the floor.
We actually went to that Mavericks-Cavs game, Mike and I did, in Cleveland, and Dirk was almost sad looking out there. He's just so slow at this point that it's difficult to watch him, and I agree that it's tough to see this Mavericks team not be able to get guys on the floor. And just harkening back to what both of you guys said about the T-Wolves, I think that at this point, you're really seeing a team that's having some of the youthful struggles that you may have expected if not for Tibbs coming in this offseason. And so it's definitely been tough for them, especially with their third quarters. They've been a bit better lately, but obviously not tonight. And I think that it might even be best for them to be in that lottery again with how deep people are saying this draft is and try to get one more guy. There's some interesting pieces and parts now for Minnesota as they try to go forward, and it'll be interesting to see how they continue to grow under Tibbs and what they end up doing in terms of potentially pursuing the playoffs or going towards the lottery.
Lastly, we're going to go into our most disappointing players that we've seen so far this year, and the guy that I'm going with is a guy who we expected or hoped that he would take on a little bit bigger role in the San Antonio team, and that's LaMarcus Aldridge. He's averaging less than 20 points a game this year, right around 18. He's struggling a bit really to kind of be one of the guys in San Antonio now that Tim Duncan's out. Granted, last year, in Duncan's last season, Aldridge definitely had a bigger role on offense, but he's really kind of struggling on defense to anchor that defense like Duncan did. He's not really the complimentary piece to Kawhi Leonard that I think a lot of people hoped he might be. The Spurs, again, they're 17-4, second place in the Western Conference, pretty solid record overall, but for the most part, their losses have been kind of inexplicable, and in those games, LaMarcus Aldridge has really struggled quite a bit.
Yeah, I think we saw a little bit of it last year. There were games where LaMarcus just didn't look engaged, and he really wondered what his role is going to be, and then he'd come out the next night and score 12 straight buckets. But yeah, he's definitely had a disappointing start to the year. My guy, I'm not exactly sure what's wrong, but mine's Aaron Gordon, and I think by far he's the best player on Orlando's team, and I don't understand why they haven't tried to utilize him. I think Orlando's in shambles from the front office all the way down. They don't really know what they're doing. Giving up Victor Oladipo, I think, was one of the dumbest things they could ever do. I think if he had stayed where he was, I think he's going to do well in OKC, but I think if he had stayed where he was going to be a tremendous player for the Magic. But, I mean, Aaron Gordon, he's averaging less than 10 points a game this year. It's hard to think what happened to him. I mean, people know him as the dunk champion, but the guy's a great player, and he was great for them last year, and it just seems like they've kind of completely gone away from him down the stretch in games, and they just aren't running anything for him. And I don't know if maybe he's hurt or what, but I'd like to see him get going. And if he continues this type of play for the rest of the year, I don't even know if he stays in Orlando long, but if someone can get him off that team, they're going to be highly acceptable of the things he can do for them.
Yeah, I think he's totally miscast in Orlando. Frank Vogel called him the next Paul George. He's not even a three in my mind. He could even be more of a small ball five than a small forward, because they're putting him in the pick and roll. He's running pick and roll as the ball handler, and he's scoring like 0.2 points per possession, which is near the worst in the league. It's actually fairly pathetic, and I think that the usage has been totally wrong from that Magic team. Like you said, it's really just a confusing situation down there. But I'm going to eliminate some bias from this podcast, and I'm going to say that my most disappointing player so far has been J.R. Smith, shirtless J.R., he of the newly minted deal, averaging 8 points, 2 rebounds, 1 assist per game, on a career low 31% from the field, 33% from 3, 46% true shooting, which is also a career low. He has the 19th worst PER in the league. He's shooting 84% of his shots from three-point land. He's 4 for his last 32. He's missed 20 straight shots. He's missed 15 straight threes. And he's really come off of this contract holdout in the offseason and not been ready to go. The Cavs are better with him on the floor. I think a lot of that is just because of who he's playing with, as well as the spacing that he does provide. But he's been off. I mean, like I said, when we went to that Dallas game, he was 1 of 11. He came out the next night, and he was 0 of 10. The Cavs are clearly trying to get him shots, but he just can't see anything go down. And I know that it was pretty bothersome to some that he had held out this summer. It seemed like the Cavs were really the only team that was going to sign him, but he wasn't there for training camp, and he has come back, and he hasn't had the legs that you would expect from a guy like him, and you kind of worry with him getting paid what that might end up looking like because of his prior issues. We all think that LeBron has kind of got him locked in. They seem to do everything together, but right now on the floor, it's pretty questionable. He did hurt his knee last night, but it seems like it's slightly minor. He might miss a couple games, so hopefully nothing bad, but he had that incident with Jason Terry where he literally left the court during a play to say what's up to a guy that he was suspended from a playoff series for elbowing. These guys have never been teammates, they don't appear to be friends, and yet he was off the court giving up a wide open layup to Tony Snell in a game that the Cavs lost and were essentially embarrassed in, like you touched on, and just like unbelievable. I know it's like an internet meme, but when you're watching that game, it's just shocking. And so J.R. Smith has really been bothering me lately.
It was pretty baffling, too, after the game where JR basically said that he didn't recall being in the game. Not really sure why you would be at the other team's bench if you weren't in the game, but I digress. Yeah, JR's definitely struggled a lot this year. He's an extremely streaky shooter. Last year, I'd say that he kind of moved from streaky to really consistent. He could carry the Cavs offense for minutes at a time. Obviously, he came out extremely hot in the second half of Game 7, where he put up the first 8 points of that half for the Cavs. He's an extremely good shooter. He obviously provides a lot of spacing for LeBron when he's on the floor, whether he's making shots or not. His shots will fall eventually, but right now it definitely is disappointing, especially because of the holdout, especially because of the kind of on-court and off-court antics that we've kind of seen from him in the past, and now they're starting to come up a bit in the present. Hopefully they don't persist going forward. I believe in JR. I think we all here believe in JR, and that
he'll the temple of swish,
and that he'll be all right going forward, but yeah, right now he's definitely struggling quite a bit.
Yeah, I think as Cavs fans, we don't really know how things actually work in the NBA, because usually when guys do hold out, they have a little bit of a rough stretch. But when we saw that with Tristan, it was the complete opposite. Tristan really bet on himself, and it worked.
Tris Kardashian.
Yeah, I mean, he's been unbelievable ever since he held out and got paid. But it might be just that JR wasn't around early on in training camp, and it might just come with time. But any good shooter knows that you got to shoot your way out of these slumps. So I think JR will be fine down the stretch. Like you said, they're still hunting him shots, and he's still playing his minutes. It's not like some of these other guys, like we touched on with Aaron Gordon, where they're just completely lost out on the court. I mean, JR's just missing shots, and those will fall. It's not like he's turning the ball over left and right and like doing crazy things out there. He's just missing shots, and just get in the gym and keep shooting, and he'll be fine.
All right, that does it for this quarter poll awards edition of the No Long Twos podcast. Thank you for joining us via the Skype hotline, Mike.
No problem, guys. Good luck with finals, Mike. Jake, keep up the good work out there. Hopefully see you guys soon. Maybe I'll take another trip out to Philly during break or something. We can catch up.
And as always, Jake here in the lab in Philly.
Yeah, glad to be chopping it up in the lab yet again. Basketball on in the background. We both got our signature chairs going. Not a great night weather-wise in Philadelphia, but a good night basketball-wise. Definitely happy to be here with you guys.
Thanks again to everyone for listening, subscribing, telling your friends, whatever you're doing to help us out. We really appreciate it. We should be back with you sometime next week. Like I said, I have finals. Mike has finals. We'll figure something out going forward. But thanks again to everyone for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Trust the process. It's BTI.
Insurance-minded speeches from Geico.
It's a common expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. However, what if the horse's mouth is filled with useful insurance tools? This is the exact case with the Geico app. Yes, the app is free and therefore a gift horse. However, look inside the app and behold, emergency roadside assistance, digital ID cards, bill pay. Get the Geico app. Look it in the mouth. Get amazing services. Thank you.